Welcome to the SEI podcast series, a production of Carnegie Mellon University's Software Engineering Institute. The SEI is a federally funded research and development center sponsored by the Department of Defense and operated at Carnegie Mellon. A transcript of today's podcast is available on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcasts. My name is Eileen Rubel, and I'm the initiative lead for the Agile and Government practice here at the SEI. Today, I'm excited to sit down with Bobby Stempley, who in June of 2017 was appointed the director of the SEI's CERT division. Bobby, you are our inaugural interview on our brand new podcast series that we're launching, highlighting the work of women in software engineering and cybersecurity. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, it's a really important topic, so really my pleasure to be here.
I'm so glad. So why don't we start by having you tell us a little bit about your role as the director of CERT. What do you do on a day-to-day basis, and what are the coolest, most interesting, or most fun parts of your job?
Oh, gosh. So it is a great job. The people, I think, is the most fun part of my job. I have the real privilege of working around some of the smartest people on the planet and really have the opportunity to help them be incredibly successful. And the problems we solve are not yet solved. And so, you know, it's really that exciting elixir that's there. Day to day, it's really hard to say what I, no 2 days are the same when you're the director of the CERT division there. But I spend a lot of time on thinking about what are the strategic challenges that we need to be focused on, helping ensure that we're aligned well enough to take on those challenges, really communicating with the staff, and removing barriers from the world that they're faced with.
Okay, great. Can we go back a little bit to your early experiences in the field or before the field? How did you decide that you might want to work in software or cybersecurity? Did you program as a kid, solve lots of puzzles, really good at math? Tell me from the beginning.
So let's start with, I'm not a spring chicken. So computers didn't exist in homes when I was growing up, right? My dad bought a computer for our home. I don't know, I probably was in fifth grade, and it was not really more than just a word processor, right? And so in school we had the TRS-80s, right? The trash 80s. That's what they were called. Yep. I know Radio Shack hates that, I'm sure, but you know, we had these very interesting computing infrastructures and environments, and they were fun to play with, and yeah, that was great. Math and I have always gotten along. I think math is a beautiful language for the world, and I think that's really an important era. But I think as I started, I went to high school in southeastern Arizona, and it was a big regional high school, so they bused kids in from all over the place. And as I sort of started figuring out what I wanted to do, I found my way into engineering kinds of courses, and really tried to find my way that way, and they weren't really there. And so my high school did away with AP for resource decisions. They didn't have enough money effectively to have an AP program. And so there were, I don't know, probably 20 of us who wanted to, you know, we'd taken every math that was available at the high school, and we were sophomores, I think, at that point. Maybe we were juniors. I can't remember. And so we got the community college. The school worked with the community college and had a professor come over and teach calculus in high school at the time, which is not uncommon today, but back then really wasn't,
wasn't mainstream.
It wasn't really very mainstream. So it's really interesting, the sort of figuring out then what that meant in terms of going to college and a job. I've got one daughter who's a computer engineer, graduated from Virginia Tech, phenomenal opportunity, but I keep telling her that when I graduated from college, engineers couldn't find jobs. Nobody remembers those days.
Wow.
Right. See, people are like, What? I mean, I graduated from college in 1991, and I got rejection letter after rejection letter after rejection. I'm sorry, there. We don't need an engineer. 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 And it's just not the world we live in today. And so, you know, it almost didn't happen. I almost didn't end up in software and computing.
Did you have any particular mentors or somebody who you felt really encouraged you along the way as you were making these decisions and sort of making your own path?
My dad, in a really big way, and my mom as well. They're a really good team. My dad always taught me that no wasn't, if you asked a yes or no question, be prepared for a no answer. So okay. Ask a question in a way that was a how question.
Oh.
And so not could you do X or Y, I want to do this, how do we do it? And one of the best pieces of advice he ever gave me.
Great advice.
Yeah, yeah. And I, for once, was smart enough to listen to my dad. not always.
Right.
I have not always been that way. And my mom taught me that you can always go back and learn. My mom has been a lifelong learner. She, you know, went to school late in life. She, you know, got her bachelor's degree later in life, not sort of the traditional approach that we pushed for. I certainly pushed for my kids, and so just continued to learn. And so I've been that sort of lifelong learner.
I'm sure that's obviously done you really well. So we talked a little bit about your school pulling back on AP classes for financial reasons and the hiring environment for engineers when you graduated from college. Did you encounter any other new roadblocks or stumbling blocks, either in school or as you made your way through your career, that you'd like to talk about?
Roadblocks and stumbling blocks. So I finally got a job. About 6 months after I graduated, I got hired by the Department of the Army to be an intern, which is wonderful. Thrilled. I expect, you know, I threw my resume out to the entire country, figured I would move wherever the job was, and lo and behold, I got a job back in the same town that my high school was in. It was not the way I expected the world to land. They're great people, incredibly smart engineers. I was, other than the secretary, I was the only other female in the office.
I've been there.
Yeah, yep. That's sort of been our lives. And they were, these guys couldn't wait for the intern to show up. I've told this story a bunch of times. They couldn't wait for the intern to show up because they had a box of things to be shredded.
Oh.
You know, and I'm like, okay, this is not exactly the world I want to be in. And, you know, I sat in front of this box and looked at it, and then I went to the ladies' room and cried because, you know, I was 21 years old, and I thought this was, like, the most amazing thing in the world,
right.
And, you know, here we go. And then I started reading the documents that were in that box before I shred them.
Huh.
And so, you know, really want to believe that everything in front of you is an opportunity, and, you know, it's really about my attitude towards that opportunity. And, you know, that experience more than anything really taught me that it's my attitude that makes a huge difference. And I can be as large as I need to be, or as stubborn as I need to be, or as whatever, but that's entirely on me.
Great. That was an interesting story.
They were phenomenal individuals, really smart guys. It was an interesting place to work right out of college.
And cut your teeth and
yes.
move on to other experiences.
Exactly.
So let's talk for a little bit about the dearth of women working in software and cybersecurity. And we know that as cybersecurity attacks become more frequent, jobs in information security are expected to skyrocket. The Department of Labor estimates that by 2020, there will be, 1.4 million computing-related job openings. In 2017, there were something like 350,000 current cybersecurity openings, according to CyberSeek. But according to a recent NBC News report, only about 11% of cybersecurity professionals today are women. What are your plans, your hopes to address this gender gap specifically at CERT?
So that is a really complex question because there are several pieces that play together. But the first one is there are millions, there's a million unfillable jobs in cybersecurity. And that means there just aren't enough people.
Right.
And so we have to grow the number of people who understand how to resolve cybersecurity related issues, who are focused on it. We need to automate things, mm-hmm. right? So we need more software folks who are smart in order to do that. And we can bring women in, but the other interesting statistic is that more than half of them leave mid-career. And so it's not just how do we bring them in, it's then how do we keep them in that space. And it takes a real holistic approach, right? We have to really focus on things like the Rooney Rule. I love the Rooney Rule, right? The Rooney Rule says you have to have diversity candidates
right.
as a part of all of your selection pool. And you have to commit to diversity
right.
candidates as a part of your selection pool. And I think that's an important part of the beginning. Now, that means they have to exist.
Right?
And
you have to attract them.
You have to attract them into. So they have to come into the pipeline. And you have to do it in a way that they are willing to stay in that pipeline. Mm-hmm. In CERT, we're really focused on getting the best candidates for every position that we have. And I want the best candidates for every position that we have to be someone with a diverse background, right?
Right.
A woman, underrepresented minority, is to be considered for all of this. And so we're really committed to opening the aperture to recruiting from each of those places. That's not enough.
Right.
We also then have to create a cultural environment in the place that overcomes the bro culture, the hard hat culture, all of those sort of cultural issues. And it's a real challenge in security because every metaphor we use in security is a male-dominated metaphor.
They're about warfare or sports or things like being a rock star.
That's right.
And
teenage boy in a hoodie, male-dominated adversary.
Right.
Alice and Bob communicate with each other. Evil is Eve in sort of the traditional crypto allegories. And so we really have to create a narrative that speaks to a larger community. And that's really a part of what we've got to be able to do in that landscape. And it's really complicated because women have to be seen as credible technically, credible communicatively, and credible in an understanding of how adversaries function. And we have to really focus on growing everybody's understanding of those three.
Well, thanks for your insights on that.
Oh.
One trend that we recently talked about in a previous podcast is that high school girls take more than half of all mm-hmm. advanced placement tests, or they're more than half of all AP test takers, is more accurate. But boys continue to outnumber girls by 4-1 in taking computer science AP exams.
Mm-hmm.
The data from 2014 said that there were three states, Mississippi, Montana, and Wyoming, where not a single girl took the AP computer science exam. Do you have any thoughts on changes in approach in primary and secondary education that might help with that early pipeline to encourage those studies at the primary and secondary level?
Yeah, so my kids hate when I do these things because I use them as great allegories for this sort of situation. It's horrendous that it's a 4-1 ratio.
Yeah.
And you know, beyond the fact that I have three children, one of whom has gone into the social sciences as a psychologist, one is a computer engineer, and my third is about to start college in math and music. He's going to major in math and music. And the thing I found watching them all grow up is you get the girls in, and you lose them when it becomes time for them to have to stand up to their boyfriends.
That's an interesting observation, and I have anecdotes that support it too.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
And you know, we have to raise our girls to be determined and focused and want to have the world be the way that they want it to be. And we have to raise our boys to make the space for that. And I think that's an important part of how we do this mm-hmm. for the community as a whole. And the important piece in that, that perhaps will correct itself over time, I without attention it won't, is we've got to look at all of the subtle messages folks get. Right? Remember pager days, right? They don't mm-hmm. make pagers for women's clothes. They don't right. make VR headsets for women's faces. We right. don't have machine learning data sets that reinforce kinds of activities. And so we right. really have to push in all of these ways and be constantly vigilant about all of the subtle ways that we're removed from the discussion.
Right. That we have to work harder to even get a seat at the table.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so, you know, my kids, like I said, my kids hate it when I use them as examples. But having watched them all go through this, I really became committed to creating the space for in secondary school, the space for girls to have a voice and continuing to engage in that space.
Great, thanks. I really appreciate your insights, and I really appreciate you taking the time today to talk with me about this. This is one of my favorite things to talk about in my work, too. So
I appreciate your being passionate about it. It's a really important topic, so I look forward to where the podcast goes.
Great. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
This podcast is available on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcasts and on Carnegie Mellon University's iTunes site and SEI's YouTube channel. As always, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to email us at info@sei.cmu.edu. Thank you.